gonna go ahead and get started. We got a full agenda this afternoon. First up, we have a request for funding for a public art master plan. And Ms. Amadio, Mr. Please. Powers, would you like to lead off on this?
The thorn between two roses.
No, other way around.
Okay. First of all, thank you very much for allowing us to present here. Brad Jones, our chairman, is in L.A. at this time, and he regrets not being here. But as you can see, it's going to take 2.5 of us to equal him. So what I want to pass out first, there's plenty. I just realized that I should be passing this out, so that's why you don't have it ahead of time. I'm going to go into it first in two details. But I want to introduce first two of my trustees. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Larry?
Yeah, I'm Larry Guzzi, for those of you who don't know me. I'm the Senior Vice President and Chief People Officer at Think Mutual Bank. I also am the incoming President of the Rochester Arts Center Board and a trustee for the Greater Rochester Arts and Cultural Trust.
Joe Powers with Powers Ventures.
Duh. Nothing else.
Yeah.
Is
that a new company?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to give, because it's been a while since we've been here, and I just want to give a reminder to people, and I think Nick is new, the history of the trust, okay, because we started and were incorporated 2006, and the city gave $30,000 to the Rochester Arts Council to hire an executive director and to get the Arts Council up and running. So it was the investment by the city that had this body first formed that then transitioned into the trust. So essentially, the city has funded what has become the trust since 2008 with that one $30,000 investment, which I have to say has, in our own opinion, has had a very good return on investment at this point, because we're still here. I also then want to give you a brief update on the progression the trust has been making over the past few months, since the last time we had come here. And we've been evolving. We meet quarterly, so we've had like two meetings, and we've been working on fundamentals and vision and whatnot, and basically getting our feet on the ground and whatnot, and coming into the concept of this generative governance and becoming a generative board. Last week, I had the fortune of being invited as one of three panelists to Hamline University to discuss for the 2015 Nonprofit Leadership Summit. And I have to just read this because I won't get it right otherwise, and it leads into what you're going to be looking at. The focus was on emerging trends in nonprofits and adapting business models and organizational systems for increased impact and sustainability. And I was asked to speak because of this generative model that we established for the trust. Now, on the handout that I gave you, I'm not going to go through the different types, but there's a definition of generative governance there. And then on the back of the form, just to remind everybody, it'd be like the third page, okay, that these are the Board of Trustees, so that you can see again the caliber of the people who consented and wanted to be on the board, representing all segments of the population, because it was different areas that we took to have representation. It's not the old Arts Council board, okay? It's a generative think tank body. And then referring to the organizational chart, and this was new and was just adapted from the last time that we spoke to you, and a picture is worth 1,000 words. There are extra copies around, and many people council. But again, this is internal. This is a document similar to what the organizational chart of, say, a Mayo Clinic, any business organization would have. Okay, so this is an internal document of how we govern ourselves. So there is the body of the trustees, under which is the CEO, and then the CEO coordinates volunteers, project-based consultants, which is what we will be discussing today, and also generative goals. And the generative goals that we are looking at are workforce development, arts consumer cultivation, policy development, arts experience enhancement, economic development, and regional initiatives. It's higher level proponents or concepts of what we're dealing with. And the one that we're before you today is policy development, which deals with public art policy. Early on in our discussions as a trust, we realized that one of the goals and one of our priorities was public art. And we contacted and were aware of Forecast Public Art. And I'm going to pass this down because you can look and see. Forecast is a 501c3 nonprofit. I had the pleasure of meeting them as a panelist for the Minnesota State Arts Board when I went to review them. And if you look, you can see, you know, who their donors are and whatnot. Very well known in the field, world-renowned, actually. I think they're over in Hong Kong now, too. But they also are known because they publish the Public Art Review. So you can kind of check that out and see that. They are the premier in the world of public art. And in fact, the Arts Center has invited Jack Becker, who is the executive director, to come down for the kickoff for the Red Ball event that's going to be coming in June. And so this is where we are right now with what our body is, how we're set up to govern with this generative concept. And at this point, I'm going to turn this over to Larry, and he's going to discuss the public art proposal that I believe is already in your packets.
And what we're here today is basically to ask for your partnership in creating this public art master plan for the city and region of Rochester. I mentioned those few different titles earlier because I'm just one of 17 people on the board and represent an interest in advancing the arts and just making a better environment and city to support the arts in Rochester. So what we're doing is, the landscape of Rochester obviously is changing. The change that's coming in the coming years with art and a need to understand public art and to have a master plan is what we're proposing to accomplish. Forecast, as Barry mentioned, is an industry leader in this space. Basically, what they're proposing is a three-phase approach. I'll boil it down to three things: what we have, what we want, and how we get there. The first, what we have, just exactly that. What is the assessment of what currently exists in Rochester, and what's the landscape look like? What we want, this section is really about engaging the public and figuring out what is it as a community that we want the arts to be in Rochester, and engaging public and stakeholder in that discussion. So that's the second part of the plan. The third is the delivery, putting the plan together and then figuring out how do we execute on it. What are the public policies that need to be in place to advance the initiative? Brad, as Barry mentioned, couldn't be with us today, but he did meet with the committee called the Arts Collaborative, had a very positive and productive meeting, specifically brought copies of the proposal to share, and everyone agreed that Forecast was a good leader to do this, and that it's vitally important that all arts organizations and artists participate and engage in the process, which is what that second phase is all about. So it is our intention to make this an inclusive and a holistic process. We think it's important that together arts philanthropists, and the city is engaged, invested, and supportive of this public art master plan. So,
really, I'm here representing the business side, and that's originally why I got involved in it, but I've done a lot of reading about other cities that have had great success, cities of our size, and the city's larger, and I think we do a really good job with arts in the community. I think we can do a better job of engaging, especially private businesses, to be a part of it, so there isn't so much stress on the public part. And communities that are succeeding are doing that. So you might almost say it almost be a match for every public dollar that they can receive, they would go out and find public or private money. And the communities that have done this have had great success. I think we do a fantastic job with our arts. But when I look at the type of employee that we are going to have to try to bring to our city and be a part of this city, we need to really put some money into this game and be a big part of it going forward so we can compete against larger cities. I mean, let's face it, you know, when you look at Mayo and you look at a lot of the other companies that we have here in town, they all have competitors and most of them are in larger cities. We've got to have a reason to come here. Surely it's not our winters, but there can be fun things to do also in the wintertime here, and we've proven that too. So that's why I got involved with it, because again, I've read about cities that have really engaged and got involved in their arts and they're really succeeding. And yeah, sports are important. Those types of entertainment are important, but the arts is something that is ongoing and it needs to be a part of, you know, everybody talks about DMC. It needs to be a part of DMC, but how about the designed aspect of DMC and where we can do that? Flood control was one of the greatest projects we ever did. It sure would have been nice to have a little more in place with the art side of it to, you know, beautify it. Doesn't mean we can't do it going forth, but it's something that needs to be a part of each project that we do.
So what we're looking for today is your approval. We're requesting that you match what we've already raised, which is $15,000, with an additional $15,000 from the city to partner with us in this project.
And I would like to say that we have that all the trustees have contributed to this because they believe in it, in addition to other private individuals, Gus Schifolius, Meyer, Tree and Lawn, and Think Bank, etc. So it's a whole range of people that have from the community.
All right. Questions or comments, Mr. Bilbeck?
First of all, I really appreciate what you said, Larry. I think it's important. What we've seen happen in this city over the last few years is groups have divided and gone on their own and made combative groups. I think the fact is we have to have all groups of art involved in this, and they need to have a place where they feel they're being heard. I think we've seen too many of our organizations today split, and they've been not productive, and they're not ever going to be productive until the day they can get them together. That's important. Art, I don't know what it is. I mean, the book you passed around, you had a person who had armpit tattooed in their armpit. To me, that's, but whatever. That's into the beholder themselves. But I do think, and one thing I want to hear, I want to make sure, is that you guys are working with all our local art groups. They're not always going to agree, I understand that, but they need to have a place at the table. They need to be heard. So, thank you.
Would you talk a little bit more about phase two of the project and how you are going to involve the arts communities and others in this master planning process?
Well, and Jack Becker, who is the executive director of Forecast, is very forthright about this, holding community meetings, getting people involved, because and facilitating, as you can see, because the plan is individual to Rochester. You know, I was looking, you know, Cary, North Carolina is similar to us. I mean, we can compare ourselves to Chicago and whatnot, or people say you're not Chicago. But this is a thriving community. It's in the Triangle region of, you know, North Carolina, Duke, and, you know, the Research Triangle. They were also in Money Magazine as one of the best places to live. High educational, you know, high median income, and they have 100,000 people. And they also have a public art plan that the entire community is involved in, and they have a way to set up so that everybody's on the same page. we don't even know what public art is. You know, this gentleman might think it's one thing, you know, Gregory thinks it's something else. So there needs to be a common language first that everybody in the community can agree upon. That's what Jack and his team facilitate with doing that. But you have to come to the meetings. When the meetings are called, you have to come. Or, you know, we see who doesn't come, and then maybe you get the names, and then you know who's complaining and who's not coming. You know, maybe that's something. But he is very adamant that this plan cannot be done unless everybody cooperates and everybody is listened to and everybody is cooperative. And we all have shared language as to, which Gregory likes to say, which is, what is public art? And really, what do we want to see for our city?
That's a nice part about that second phase, is it's really about educating and listening to what our community wants.
Mr. Campion?
Yeah, I think we're on the same page in a lot of respects. It sounds like this idea of how do you engage these other groups, encourage that participation is principal, frankly, to the success of a plan like this. So one of the things that's kind of come up is, you know, this idea of transparency, and we hear about this all the time on Fox News about your dollars being invested in ways you can't see the money after that investment happens. What kind of, like, oversight, you know, what can the public count on in terms of having insight into how this is playing out? Because I think that's one of those elements. I see two elements here that are kind of keep cropping up in a lot of the concerns I'm reading is, well, how does the public get that insight into, you know, there's a lot in here that says from the direction of the trust. And I think trust is a delicate word in many ways beyond its current usage. But how do we, you know, is the trust the right organization? Should we be looking at, you know, we can say get to the table, but do we bring more people to the table if we kind of give them a seat of some determination versus just saying show up and participate in kind of this this classroom way? Is there a way to get those people in ownership roles so that they're compelled to bring their organizations to bear in the same way?
One of the reasons we included who is on the trust, because you hear trust and it's easy to look at an entity and identify that, but look at who makes up the trust. I mean, these are people who are used to listening to people,
yeah,
who their job is to do that. And I think if, you know, that's what Forecast Public Art is tasked with doing as well. So, and then educating in that second phase.
And the city gave us originally $20,000 matching grant for the geese. Okay, that was all out in the open, you know, sponsorships, whatever, the geese are all around. We've never been accused of not being transparent with anything that we've done. As far as, you know, being good stewards of money that has been given to us. So, you know, there's going to be press releases, people coming. You know, part of it, too, is that the trust is a legal entity. Okay, we're a 501c3, all right? We answer to the IRS, we answer to, you know, you can find out about us on GuideStar, et cetera. And so we're out there taking the leadership to get this going, but it's a success if people come on board and help with implementation of it. You know, we're not a body that implements necessarily the items. We're not going to be out there putting public art, whether it's temporary or, you know, like RDA is doing Red Bloom, okay, or Red Ball, I should say. You know, we're not doing it. So the city's getting involved with that through RDA. So there's opportunities for people to come about, do this plan, see what the parameters are that the city wants, because the plan then comes back to city council. And city council has to look at it, adopt it, tweak it, whatever you want to do with it. And then it doesn't get put in a drawer. It's the responsibility of everybody in the community to then see things going forward. So you want to have more temporary public art? Okay, what group is going to do that? The collaborative is certainly welcome. You know, it's a committee, but it's certainly welcome to go try to do what they want to do with assistance, with what. So people know what's going on. In this community right now, this hand's here, this hand is here. And I have to tell you, I took this out. It was in a New York newspaper, and I kind of switched theater to arts, and it says, the wonderful thing about the arts is that it has so many people involved in the creation of it. the worst thing about the arts is that it has so many people involved in the creation of it. You know, I mean, people need to come together. This is a first step, okay? And phase two is where everybody in the arts community has a chance to do that. Because quite frankly, I'm getting tired of hearing the arts don't get along. There's an opportunity for the arts to get along and everybody to be heard. And it's not the trust leading it, it's forecast leading this, okay? We have oversight, but so does everybody else in the community to speak up about it.
Mr. Ruskin.
I guess when I think of the arts in Rochester, I think of Joel Powers. Well, not actually.
But I think it's through the meeting without taking one shot.
I think that's what's great about this thing, though, is that I hope that we can pull the efforts together of everybody and not just have certain segments talk to and certain segments with the input. I think, you know, if the efforts of this step can be to pull people together and to hear people out and to work on plans that incorporate everybody to build communication, then it's been a positive thing. So that's what I'm kind of getting at. You know, Joe, you're not maybe a big arts guy. You're still involved because you understand the importance of this, and I think we all do. So, you know, hopefully the communication can be stronger. We can be more positive going forward. But the question would be is what can we expect to see with measurables as far as progress, short-term and long-term, with this investment? What are you thinking about bringing back maybe to us or to the community?
Yeah, well, according to Jack Becker, he's looking at a four-month, you know, that this is going to take 4 months. So, you know, if you want us to make monthly reports or however, you know, you see.
I would think, like, if they're going to do 4 months, maybe like in 6 months, you get us report back on kind of the outcomes and some measurables and some things that you learned through the process. That would be helpful to me. I don't know how everybody else feels. But
that is the plan, is to deliver back to you a master plan document.
Right, okay. Which you will have to adopt.
And then in about 6 months, that'll...
Yep. Yeah. Wait, the council would adopt a master plan? Did I hear that correctly?
Were they not interested in doing it?
But I thought this was a private entity.
No, it's a partnership.
Here we go again.
Oh.
Yeah, I think this gets a little bit to my concern about if this is going to be a public adopted plan, I would feel more comfortable with it being led and steered by a public board that has that level of transparency. We have this with the majority of master plans that we do. No matter who's kicking it off, there's accountability to people who, and don't get me wrong, you guys have a reputation in the community that I'm sure you'd be willing to stand up and defend, but people that are accountable to voters in the end for, you know, however that works. A lot of times the dollars in other communities flow into the government to run the plans, go through these. Does that make sense more as now the government has a little bit of control over what the outcome and result of this will be? Especially if the expectation is going to be we need to adopt it, I think then this allows us to set the expectations on a group that would be driving this.
Can I make one comment there? You are represented by the council president, and you're also represented by the mayor on our board.
Is that by invitation or by choice?
It's by choice.
So
the council has appointed those individuals to these positions.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah. So I mean, that's kind of the issue we get to. I mean, if you're just a private nonprofit, you know, you don't need me to put the stamp of approval on your governance model. But when I look at this, you know, who's on the trust? What's jumps out at me, there's no art people. So, I mean, it's your nonprofit, you can do anything you want. And I get it that you might want a mix, but having a governance model that includes no arts people, to me, seems odd.
Well, actually, we have arts organizations represented by Ellen Houston, who is the Minnesota, she's under the officer list.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, where's she? Oh, hi there. Okay, and actually, Michael Brennan is a potter.
But his position on the board is a representative of Rochester Catholic
School. Well, no, we just put his title on there. Because the K through 12 education is actually Sue Mackard, who is executive director of the Perfect Center for Arts Education.
So, I mean, they're all great people, but that's the thing that jumps out at me.
Well, because this is... as I had said, Mark, this is not the old Arts Council, you know, where you had, you know, composition of arts organizations and whatnot. This is a totally different body where one area is represented. So you have somebody from higher ed, you have somebody from K through 12, you know, and that's the way it was set up. Sort of when you used to go in a restaurant and order one from A and one from B and whatnot. And it was to get started. Right now, it's 3-year terms, but that means then that these people are not necessarily going to be on there for, you know, the rest of their lives. So there's a way to do this. But this was not, it was to have a broader view to get all input from all segments of the...
I think you understand what I'm saying. I mean, you don't need my stamp of approval unless you want public dollars, then I've got concern with your governance model.
Well, when I say private public partnership, I'm using probably a different definition than you may be using, because we're all talking about partnerships and collaboration. So we're looking for the funding to be able to meet with the private funding that we raised, similar to what I did with the Goose Project, you know, and it's the same sort of thing.
Good point taken.
Thank you.
Mr. Billback.
Barry, can you tell, you talked about transparency. Mm-hmm. How do you let everybody know these meetings are and when they're happening? I wake up tomorrow and I feel suddenly artistic. I want to participate in the art world. How would I know? I mean, you talk about transparency. When do you meet? You talked about everybody knowing. How would they know? Is there going to be what form are you going to use to let everybody know that you're doing this?
Well, one thing, can I just make a comment? I mean, these are baby steps we're at right now, okay? This group is, I don't know, what do we have, five meetings?
Twice, two.
I mean, so it's like...
We meet quarterly, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't had that many meetings. In fact, I've been the guy that's kind of been in the room going, let's get it going, come on. But it really boils down to your first question, Mark. You got all these people coming in asking for income. Because it's quite frankly, it's tough to fund arts with just private money. It's also got to come from the public. And we've done a great job here in town. Can we do better? Yes. There's got to be a better funding source. We have all kinds of funding sources for everything else in the community, but I don't see it on the arts side on having funding sources. And that's why I got involved in it, is because I don't see... I mean, yes, eventually you're going to have to look at a percentage of the sales tax, a percentage of whatever is going to have to come in and be put into that. Then you get down at the end of the year and think, okay, come in and make your presentation, and we'll listen, and then we'll all decide on who's going to get their cut.
Again, I come back to my question, though. When you start to have meetings and you're starting to want to get public input, how's that going to be shared? Because right now you're asking us, consider funding, some funding, but we haven't talked about how these outside groups then.
That is phase two. So it's about publicizing the meetings that are occurring. So whether it's directly emails to these different groups, I mean,
newspaper, radio.
That's what we're paying this group to help us with, so that we ensure that that's being accomplished. Does that answer your question?
Kind of, but that's my concern. We talk about transparency, yet we should have some model or some way that we're telling everybody this is what we're going to do to be getting that information out. That's what I'm thinking for. Mr. Russell.
Well, I would think that as this group comes in and talks to the outside groups and they identify that as a need, they could come up with identifying that as an action item and then trying to come up with solutions on how to address that.
Right.
So I would hope that would be kind of the work we'd be looking at.
And in phase one, as I said, is what do we have? So that's part of it, is identifying what are those groups, what are those arts resources that we already have. Identify them, make sure they're getting to the table in that second phase.
I would think your goal is to try to include everybody that wants to be heard.
Absolutely. That's what the public meetings are about.
Ms. Means and Mr. Campion.
Well, what I understand is the phase one really is the authorization to get the money to pull your expert in to define what we have and what we need to do, and bring that back to the trust. Secondly, you have the phase two, where then you're going to incorporate as many arts organizations that want to be involved in that decision making, including extending it regionally, as I understand. Mm-hmm. maybe not immediately, and the delivery part, you know, that's, I don't know how you're going to execute it. So that's what I'm hearing. I'm thinking that this, you know, how are you, you for sure will work with someone from the DMC organization, because we would want to collaborate with them to make sure that we're all on the same page in how we're defining public art. The other thing for me, art is, I was just in El Paso, and it struck me that the bridges were just beautiful, kind of like the one that you've illustrated here. All kinds of art, you know, very Aztec looking because of the region. But also on the bridges, there were lights and just beautiful architectural renderings that were very pleasing and many times very, very comforting. Another thing that struck me, and you may not think about this, is that the art that sometimes you see on the buildings, that's not, you look at it kind of in a negative way because it might have, you know, not too nice images on them. But if you could get those artists that have extreme talent to participate in this project with their art, then you're getting like a monstery cloth where it's also telling a story and reflecting on their own personal experiences in the art, which I think is really important as we consider being inclusive of all kinds of art. You know, not discounting one as not classic and one as contemporary and one as modern. But it tells a story. It also reflects who we are as a community, and I'd like to see that group pulled in. I think, you know, I think the master planning idea is a good one as a good start. The big step is getting others involved. Mm-hmm. The other thing I see about a 501c3 is that that way you can solicit funds and people can get credit for their charitable donations. Mm-hmm. So that's what I see as positive. Now, I would need to hear more about our city attorney's comments since we have to approve it and how that would work. I'm not sure about that piece, but my first take on this is, good grief, it's time we got together and did something positive and in a coordinated way to present and represent us in this community as a destination that's reflective of many different types of artists.
If I could just say, nothing is ever written in stone, and so the adoption concept is subject to change depending upon how the city council feels about that. But I want to go back to your DMC comment, because when you said that, it clicked in my head. We sat down and went through this with Lisa Clark, and she was very particularly interested in the final overlay map of the different districts and whatnot. So, and she is a trustee on the board. So we do work hand in hand with Lisa and what is going on with DMC.
Yeah, so Sandra so eloquently hit the term that I was looking for, and I think this is where I keep kind of coming back to the issue that I'm having is, there's participation and then there's decision making. And I know, because I've participated in a lot of things and been decision maker in other contexts. And so I think that continues to kind of be a point where I'm looking to figure out, when we talk about broadening the input, broadening participation, posting a public meeting and hosting a public meeting, don't always become decision making. A lot of times that is just participation and it gets left by the wayside. So I think what I'm trying to look at is, if we need to, and frankly I'm really not interested in supporting a plan that doesn't eventually end up in some sort of adoption of a public policy change, I'd like to find something. If we're going down that path, to me the way that we bring all the interests together is in the decision making. I believe we did this recently with the Police Oversight Commission, where a bunch of people were in the pot mixing it before it came before the council. The council ultimately reviews the product of that process and is responsible for adopting it. But I think, you know, versus us, you know, putting the money out, I would much rather see the money stay in, you know, in with our purview, with our ability for some oversight. I think kind of waiting until the last minute and getting a plan isn't, you know, how I'd like to see that play out.
It also says that the draft plan will be fully vetted and is designed to engender strong community buy-in and a sense of ownership. So my understanding is that the plan is not just going to come to the trust and, oh, here you are, but the plan is going to be vetted by the community and those people who participated in forming the plan for additional input from them. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sounds good, but it isn't necessarily what I'm seeing in the proposal. I mean, a lot of this is, for instance, under the phase two, facilitate a meeting with key stakeholder groups. And then, parenthetically, as identified and convened by the trust. It does, frankly, you know, the gatekeepers play an important role in a lot of different organizations, but it does sound like there's, you know, who is a participant is, you know, at the whim of the trust. And when it's public dollars going out to form public policy that's going to be adopted by a public body, I start to get pretty shaky on that. If, again, if this is something you guys want to run independently, I think the best way to do that is without, you know, as Councilmember Higgy pointed out, without public support. I don't think, you know, either go public support, and that has certain ramifications in my mind, or you go all private, and that's a completely different route that has different expectations.
Yeah, the identified and convened by the trust is not that we're hand-picking people. That's the terminology of the consultant. But convened means that you're hosting, you know, basically. It's not like, oh, you can come, but you cannot come type thing. So
I think it is a semantic issue, but right, as with government, everything's a semantic issue to some degree. So
yeah.
I think that's, you know, what gets to be troubling a little bit when you're reading this. It is, I mean, it came out, I believe I started seeing it Friday, and, you know, a lot of our community started seeing the proposal on Friday. So it's that nitpickiness that kind of gets to what's the public participation look like.
Well, it goes back to when we first initiated the BACE, the Building Creative Economy Initiative. That was always convened by the Arts Council, but in partnership with the Rochester Area Foundation and the RDA. So it was convened because you need to have some leadership initially, but then everybody, I mean, we had the entire community involved, you know, for 3.5 years that eventually formed what came to be the trust.
Yes, Mr. Russ. Mr. City Attorney, can you give us an idea of your thoughts on how this could be moved forward in a way that you feel fits or you feel it just isn't going to fit?
If this is a request for funding, state law allows the city to appropriate money for the arts without need of a contract, without any agreement. It's a permissible appropriation. What confuses me is this talk about the city somehow approving something. If you are interested in having a master plan that you're going to adopt as public policy, we need a contract with these people to provide them the funding, tell them what they need to do and what they need to come back with, and then you folks will take it from there. And so you need to decide, is this simply a funding request or is it more that you're seeking to have official policy to be adopted by the city, in which case we need to become more formalized in our relationship. There is no partnership. Maybe there's a working partnership, but from a legal standpoint, no, there is no partnership. If you want one, we've got to put it in place.
So they could formally adopt a, they could come forward with a master plan that they could have to work as if we don't adopt.
Right.
Mr. Mayor.
Just to follow up on that, too, I'm trying to put it in context of, we had a lot of discussion about the art, if you will, on the uptown, the 2nd Street, all the way out. What kind of, art, if you will, light poles, you know, the vegetation that was going to be there, all of that. if in this plan it was said that, yeah, whenever we do something, the plan says there should be some review of that. And using the Second Street there, the uptown area, as an example, if there were something that came out of this, the forecast group that said, yes, whenever we're doing some new area, there should be some review or so on and so forth, could we do that without, quote, adopting that plan, or can we adopt it and its guidelines, really?
I suppose we could do it after the fact. You're saying that they can put the plan together and maybe the city can come along after the fact and say, we're going to recognize that as our policy? Is that what you're asking?
I guess, yeah, kind of that
way. Yeah, you could do that, yes. But you have had no involvement in the production of that policy. But if you find it acceptable, yes, there's nothing preventing the city from adopting it.
Because in some of this, it is trying to maybe put some order into what the art will be, public art. It's not telling some artist that, no, you can't write that poem or you can't paint that, but that there's some guidelines to that. I also just want to say, certainly, I support what we're doing, you know, to get this kind of an inventory that what we would be paying for. But also, just to be clear, at least as I understand it, this is sometimes I think there's the feeling that this is like the United Way, that all the money is going to flow in there, and then they're the ones that are going to parse it out to whoever comes and applies. I don't think that's the case at all. But at times, that's kind of the thought, that somehow anybody that's given money to the trust, that's then they'll have to come and crawl in and grovel and beg for the money from that. They could still do their own thing, and but there may be then, put certainly, hopefully, money for, quote, public art, where we might want to put a new statue up for Mr. Quenwald or something, you know, at that point.
Oh, my God.
Ms. Means and Mr. Campion.
I really am in favor of this. I'm in favor of getting something concrete that we can wrap our arms around in the phase one, and then once we've reviewed it, then we can make that decision, as the city attorney mentioned, this master plan. We can decide, do you want a contract with this, or, you know, to formalize that relationship. But I think the first phase certainly is a positive step in coordinating our efforts. And you must include the spray painters.
So right now, the request, if I understand what you just said, right now the request would be an allocation for the organization. Yes. They're going to come and go through a process which results in a plan, some sort of plan. We can choose at that point or some future point what to do with it, whether to adopt it in full or in part or ignore it.
Yes, sir.
Does that take care of the issues from the city attorney's perspective?
Right. It doesn't take care of your issue in terms of oversight, but from the legal issue, yes, that at least they have been given an appropriation, and they'll do something with it in terms of a master plan, and you'll see what the result is, and you can decide at that point if anything you wish to do in response.
Okay.
I just was a little bit interested in the history of this. When did we get the request for funding?
Last week.
So sometime mid-last week, we think. Mm-hmm. And it went on the agenda for the Monday meeting. I guess my concern is in 5 days, we've turned around and now set a precedent that we're going to hand out $15,000 in kind of an undescript, nondescript way to an organization that has a lot of great people on their board. Don't get me wrong, but if another organization came and said, we also want to form a master plan, now the precedence is, do we reject the second group because they got here second? I'm a little bit concerned about what we're setting as the rationale.
Remember, this was the group that we originally funded in 2008. So we've had this group on our books and funded it for years and supported it for years, too. So, that's a difference.
If the Civic Theater came and said, we want to do a master plan, we would support them to the tune of $15,000.
That was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I just, to me, this is a little bit, I think if we're going to do this, set up the contractual way, we frankly have been down this path before. We know how to set up groups to harbor and get public input, get and collate that. You know, we have an organization whose prime job is engaging citizens.
So you'd support it if we had it contractually set up properly?
I would support it if it had the oversight of our elected body. And frankly, I'd be okay with appointing a commission to go take the steer of this, to go through this and go that way. We've done this with the police oversight. I think we have already a precedence for how to develop public policy with the public. I don't know that giving money out and just kind of saying, well, we'll see what comes back. Maybe we'll adopt it, maybe we won't. That to me doesn't really sound very fiscally responsible from my perspective.
The trust is not the one that'll be doing the study. It's the forecast that's being contracted.
I think that's a great idea. So we could, if we want, you know, if you guys wanted to make a $15,000 donation to the city, we could match it with $15,000, and then we're really good at writing contracts. I know that much. So maybe that's the way to do it, and then we can still have that oversight.
Would the contract change from what we have here other than just the governance of it?
Just the governance. I mean, frankly, I'm concerned primarily with governance as a question, because one of my constituents comes to me and says, I have an arts organization that would like to get $15,000. I now have a very difficult question to answer about why one arts organization gets it and another arts organization does not get it.
But I think, again, the presentation of what they come make their presentation, that's what we do. My feeling is I'm not so concerned about supporting it. What I want to do is I want to see something measurable come back. That's what I want to see. I want to see that $15,000 is being used for something that we're going to be able to look at. I'm not an arts person, so to ask me to oversight, be the overseer of this group really makes no sense, because you're expecting me to meet with the people who do art all the time and go, yeah, this is good, or no, this is not good. So for me to be the oversight person, I don't feel that I'm qualified. However, I do feel that I can ask this group to bring back measurable performances to come back that we can look at, and then I can make a determination whether there's a measurable amount there. If I don't, they walk away, and that's, we just,
yeah, for me, it's the same problem. I guess I completely agree. We can either skin this thing in the beginning or at the end. I mean, that's the way. If you want to wait to the very end when we've already invested the $30,000 to then,
15.
Well, it's as a community, sure, 15 for us or for the public, but if you're going to wait to the end, the money is already a sunk cost. You know, like right now what I'm trying to do is get out in front of it to say, is this the way that we want policy for the city of Rochester developed? Like, that's, to me, there's a principle argument. And I said it before, I said it again, there's principle and pragmatic, and to me this is a bit principle.
Yeah. I mean, we get groups to request money from us all the time without having any other connection to us. And we have to make the decision yes or no.
That's kind of the fundamental for the block grants.
Yeah. It's not necessarily, though, coming in asking, the expectation being we adopt, which clearly that can't be the expectation, but I think that's the piece. You know, it's a policy piece. It's certainly, I've seen a number of letters indicating some contention about decision-making power that's happening, for whatever, what you call it, what it is. How do you balance the expectations of the public with the need to build public-private partnerships?
Okay, so how do we bring this to closure for today? We have a request, and I think partially to Mr. Campion's point, we evaluate each and every request that comes before us on its own merits. Does this one pass the test, or we want to provide some sort of allocation? Where do you want to go with it?
I guess my question for Mr. Campion is, where are your comfort as a contract? What do you expect out of that contract?
Yeah. I don't want to beat a dead horse. Like, again,
no,
to me,
fine.
The
I want to hear from
to me the sure. What I could support is a commission of people appointed by the mayor and council to develop an ordinance for adoption, and then that gives us the ability to select community members who may or may not have invested interest in the different aspects of art in the community. We allow them to run the course, work directly with this group. And frankly, like you said, I don't know everything there is about arts. and I think you've admitted here today, you don't know everything about arts. So in the end, we get the broader perspective. They bring back the policy, just like the Police Oversight Commission. We take that policy, we say thumbs up, thumbs down, and we move forward. But then the investment has been shepherded by people appointed by us. We're culpable. It's not an external organization that I feel is a great organization, staffed with great people. I'll say that every single time because I think you guys are doing a valuable public asset. But the transparency is, again, coming back to me, my problem.
Mr. Quinville?
Some of my thoughts, I can understand what Nick's saying to a certain extent about oversight, but you still have the oversight at the end. You should have a product to look at and see whether or not it is something that at that point you might, you like to have some public hearings. You can have a public hearing on the product when you get it and see how it fits in. If you have oversight by yourself, I think that would probably fall into my office for the daily kind of oversight of it. And quite frankly, we're not as experienced as some of these people in seeing that oversight. So I would prefer that group that has some desires and feelings about would be the ones that oversight the development and formulation of this plan for your later review and input by others to see whether or not it is something that you wish to proceed forward with. And at that point in time, you have plenty of oversight the way I look at it.
Ms. Mead?
Can I suggest that we go ahead and proceed with the allocation of the funds for phase one, and then we can have additional, after they've talked with their trustees and their officers, we can talk about a relationship. Because right now, what I see missing is that we don't have a good coordination of efforts, and this would help pull that together, in my opinion, in the phase two area. But until we have this survey, until we complete phase one, it's critical that we have phase one completed, and I assume that $15,000 goes towards the consulting fee.
Well, phase one. I'm looking at the memo, which is split into phase one, two, and three. The total for all three phases is about $30,000.
Yeah, and that's yes.
So, but you would advocate just the first phase, which is estimated at a cost?
No, I think we should move it so that we can, start this process that I think we all feel is important. And the phase one is the one third of the process. Then we have a chance to review it after.
Okay, Mr. Russell.
Actually, phase one, if it's matching funds, if we approve $5,000 today, we'd probably get them through phase one and two. Because they have the matching funds, so that would make it $10,000 total. I prefer not to split it up, but that's kind of what we're looking at, right? If you're talking, if we give $5,000 to this, they have matching funds. That's $10,000. The first phase one and phase two are $8,000 total. That gets us a little idea to see how they engage with the other groups out there.
Mr. Hickey.
So I continue to have concerns. Even before we commit any dollars, I wouldn't even consider it unless we're going to involve a public hearing process just to get started. This has kind of been sprung on everybody in the last few days. I've gotten some feedback via email on that, but a lot of people haven't had a chance to react to this. So I continue to have concerns, and if we're even going to consider it, I think we need to have a public hearing to allow people to provide some input on it.
Mr. Mayor?
Well, I would hope you would just put it on the next council meeting on the consent agenda. I also am thinking I'm not in favor of this fragmented. President Kennedy didn't ask just money to get to the moon. He asked him, I think, to get back as well. And I just don't see any purpose in trying to just split it up and say, well, we're going to do this part and not do the whole thing. We've got to get to the moon and back.
I think there's been a lot of work and a lot of effort, a lot of input from good people to try to pull what I think is a very fragmented part of our society together here. Our community has a lot of special interest groups out there that want to be heard and think that their stuff's important, and it is all important. That's what we're trying to do here. I think it's pull it together. And if we don't have the leadership and the courage to step forward and say, let's take this on, let's see what it brings for us, I don't know that we're ever going to get very far. We sit and now we're going to take steps back if we're going to chop it in pieces. And this is a good group of people that have worked a lot of time to get to this point. And I think I have trust in the trust. I have trust in the people that I see on this list. And I think they're accountable to us, and they would be accountable to their actions. And so I'd like to see us move forward with that.
I would too. Mr. Bilderman?
Again, I want to see measurable results. My feeling is I want to see what they can do. We can walk away if it doesn't work, and some of the group can pick up pieces if they feel that's important. But I think we need to, we've put a lot of faith in this group. We've put a lot of work into this group and effort. We've heard them a lot of times since 2008. As Mr. Ruska said, some of us have been listening to them since 2009. But I'm willing to go forward with it, but I definitely want to see some measurable results come out of this. My commitment to supporting it to see what they come up with is not a guaranteed commitment for the future. It's I want to see what they can do, and I want to see, and I'd like to know some of these meetings, because I want maybe, like I said, I want to attend. I want to see what's happening. I want to see for myself if the transparency is there. So I'm willing to go forward with it. To see, but I want to make sure they understand. I want to see measurements out of it, and there's no guarantee after this.
Okay. Mr. Hickey.
So if it's on the consent agenda, I will not be supporting it. If it's part of a public hearing process, I'll keep an open mind. We'll see what else comes of it.
Okay.
I mean, I'd like administration to bring forward some alternate proposals for governance of and generation of this. What is an important piece of legislation to me? And I'm a little bit taken aback. I know Councilman Baruska wasn't trying to imply it, but I do hold every member that I see on this sheet in high esteem. I think these are leaders of the community in more ways than one. And yet, ultimately, I answer to taxpayers. And when it comes to investing taxpayer dollars, I hold that to a higher standard than maybe even sometimes I hold my own personal investment. So I think that there's a higher bar to meet here. I would much prefer a public body guide this forward. And that's just, for me, one of the steps we can easily take to get some transparency into this. But that's my preference.
Mr. Campion, how do you feel about the public hearing?
I can't see myself supporting this until I feel like there's decision-making power being granted to people elected or appointed by elected officials. That's my bar.
Even though we have the city council president and the mayor in this group.
I think you do, and I think that's really relevant, and I think it's important for our community. The hard part is we have them on the board, and I'm a bit frustrated that, I'm hearing about this with 3 days' notice. I heard about this Friday. If they're on the board, should we be getting more heads up about the stuff coming down the pipeline? I feel like, I don't want to say it's fast passed, but we're holding votes on, and I know I fought for one or two items to get on the agenda for Committee of the Whole, and that something pops up Friday that's going right on the Committee of the Whole meeting. I'm concerned. Yeah, transparency is important here, and I try and do what I can. So I think it's important that in all aspects of this, we figure out how to continue to kind of keep it a transparent process.
Okay. Well, one quick note. We've got potentially a week from today before this comes to a vote, so everyone should feel free to, do their respective homework. One of the things that concerns me is that, we're going down this path of a public hearing. Folks, we're elected to lead. We represent people, and sometimes people are going to agree with our decisions, sometimes not. If we're going to take everything to a public hearing for a $15,000 expenditure, please, we're going to be here forever. Sometimes we have to take that leap of faith. We have to trust some of the people that have put themselves out there and tried to make an effort. It's just from a procedural standpoint, I don't want to let these kinds of things fall into that kind of quagmire of all the public hearing. We have an opportunity to take that input, and we will. We've already received some, but I think we make that call. And you know what? I'll bet you even if we did have a public hearing and we're going to make a call, and people are still not going to like our decision. That's why we're here.
Oh yeah,
why do we make the big bucks, guys?
I think though my 2 cents response would be the easy vote here is to just give out the $15,000 and not ask any questions. The hard vote for me is taking people that I respect a lot and telling them that I'm concerned about the transparency of the organization. That's not the easy vote. You know, I respect every single person sitting at the end of this table and what they've done. And yet I have to look them in the face, and I will, and say, I am concerned about the transparency for the tax dollars associated with giving your organization $15,000. So I'm not trying to take an easy route. I'm not trying to shirk my responsibility as an elected official. I'm trying to make sure that people are represented in the decision making.
So tell me what you want.
I think I've reiterated this multiple times. I want a commission put together with oversight over the drafting of the public policy relating to an ordinance on art in our community.
You want to go down the path of forming a public arts commission?
I think that it's, if $15,000, and we're going to do 50-50, because maybe this doesn't end at $15,000. I know there's been several projects lately where we thought we've been done funding, and the next thing you know, we're not done funding. This is not going to be, I don't think this is a one-time stop. And frankly, the expertise problem comes up too, that having more public expertise brought to bear on whether or not this is a good policy for the community, it's a win-win to me. It's a win that we get additional well-educated, you know, in the community insight into this. That's my perspective on it.
Mr. Mayor.
I just again reminded that none of us are going to be doing the study. We're hiring an expert. To me, that's like saying we're going to hire Rembrandt, and now we've got the experts that are going to say, no, you used the wrong brush. You know, it's the experts, and they have a track record of being the best in the business to do it. That's who we're really hiring with this. None of us have got that kind of expertise.
And
so
sometimes you have to be the only one to stand that way. Again, I said I'd be willing to take a donation of $15,000 from the trust if they wanted to do that. We could contract with that group. Then again, we are setting the expectations of the contract. We would be responsible for that. I'm not trying to be intransient, but I'm not going to change my opinion on this one.
Mr. Russell?
I was just going to say, I don't think Mr. Campion aimed this at me, but I think he did say that the easy way is to give the money without asking questions. And I think we've all asked a lot of good questions, and I think we're concerned and we're responsible and we're acting in what we think is good faith in a group that has put a lot of their time and effort into this. So
I think that.
All right. So, Mr. Quinto?
I'd be a little bit leery about setting up a separate arts commission. And then you have to put your duties and responsibilities down for them, and what are they going to do after they get done with the master plan? So if, simplistically, I think you're better off proceeding without establishing such an entity. And I do realize there's a lot of fractured feelings among the arts community. I mean, I'd approach with some trepidation myself trying to put together a particular master plan scenario. I really think the way this is set up will provide you at least a finished product of a master plan that will be a step forward, and it's something that you as the governing body can then hold a public hearing on, and you can accept or reject it at that point in time. At least for your $15,000, you would get a finished product. And we have, as a city organization, provided money for these types of things in the past. Rather, I shouldn't say easily, but you've done it without a lot of trepidation and public input. Because, again, we do have a representative democracy, and you are elected by the people to make these types of decisions. And I think the expenditure of the $15,000 for the production of a arts master plan is a good expenditure, in my view. And Mark mentioned that he wanted to, Mark Bilderbeck, on a measurable product. Well, a master plan that would be acceptable to you and the general public at that point would be, how would you measure the success of that initiative?
Mr. Ruskin?
I was just going to say, since 2008, this group has been very careful with any dollars that we've given it and found ways to be very resourceful, creating their own dollars and to try to have good input into the arts in our community. So I think we need to remember that. We talked about well, is this the beginning of more expenditures? I think they're going to be very careful and they'll use the dollars very, very wisely. So, keep that in mind.
So, I'm hearing that the direction for staff would be to go ahead and put this on the consent agenda and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. We'll start stuff. Consent stuff isn't consent anymore. Mm-hmm.
And you can all help all by right. buying tickets to Dancing for the Arts there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Almost sold out, so please get your tickets.
Thank you.
All right. We've got a couple other things, and Mr. Martinson, you want to get us started? I apologize. We kind of cut you short again, and we still have one besides that.
Yeah, I was thinking we'd push it out to another meeting. But.
All right.
Should be
each one. This is just one by itself.
Okay. All right.
Can you get one of these?
So this first sheet is already in your packet, your electronic packet. The second two pages are just to try and cover the finance department overview briefly. And again, this is our first attempt at trying to do this budget sort of a wrap-up from 2014, which is difficult to do because in about another month and a half, we're going to have the auditors come in and spend about an hour or half, at least a half hour on that same topic. So when we just tried to look at a way to how to show you a quick picture of it, we basically are trying to summarize 19,000 ledger accounts here, and we basically took it into the 20 operating funds. And it may be a little bit unfair because, again, the general fund has a lot of different business units in it, but I did give you the detail printout. It was sent to you a couple of weeks ago now. And we'll try to answer questions as you go along here, and you may have some more from that detailed report that we sent out. Carrie McNallan from our office, the assistant finance director, which you probably remember during the budget process, that he's sitting back here in the back row, he can help answer some of those more detailed questions too. But we'll just kind of get into this and then see where it goes, because I realize we don't have a lot of time here left. So what I'm just showing is the actual fund balance that ended at the end of the year. Again, these are unaudited numbers, but and then that's the first column. The right, far right column is just the change from the prior year. So when you take all the revenues and all the expenditures and you net out the bottom, what was the net change of that fund at the end of that year, at the end of 2014? So again, within each fund, there's a bunch of different business units that have revenues and expenditures, but I'm just trying to summarize this. So in the general fund, which is the one largest supported by our tax levies, we had a net $2.3 million, almost $2.4 million gain in that fund balance at the end of the year. And that was that amount of money that was recommended recently for that rec center project that we went around and around about. But that fund balance needs to grow a little bit every year because you may recall we have this target, again, set by the state auditor, where we're trying to keep 5 months or about 41-42% of our expenditures in the current year as an operating fund balance. And that's our target, and it's kind of our target for most of these operating funds, which we don't make that a number of the others. But with that $2.3 million, that's over what we quite needed to get there. We're probably a million and a half over what we actually had to get to for this year to keep that target going. Again, multiple departments within there. I'm not trying to take away from their presentations. One of them is coming right after me. So those details I sent you, again, at a summary level, but each one of those departments will be coming to you anyway and talking about their individual department. The other ones that are listed here, the 200s and 600s, they actually have a fair amount of revenues besides tax levy coming to them, so they end up with their own separate fund balances. Again, the library gets a significant amount of county money. But they ended up with a $110,000 positive gain in their fund balance at the end of the year. We're still trying to build that fund balance up to reach that somewhere in that 40% range, and we're a ways away from that yet. But we're getting closer, and that was primarily salary savings. F.E. Williams Fund is actually just this dedicated trust that for a while we tried to keep, the park department controls that, but we tried to keep that only using the interest earnings from that fund in any year. But as you're probably well aware, interest earnings are pretty much nil these days, and so they are starting to draw down the fund balance every year just to be able to get some of their primary playground equipment and stuff out of that. And then this whole park and rec group here, the park fund itself ended up with $381,000 to the good, but that's offset by the golf fund, which again had a loss this year of $107,000. Grand Marina, $20,000. We actually split probably a $40,000 shortfall with the county on that one. The volleyball center, just a small loss. And then the rec center, again, that had a $56,000 loss this year. But overall, gain in the park and rec fund all combined of $193,000. Again, we're not to the point where we want to be with that fund. We're probably in the 24% range or something like that, and we really want to get to a higher level. We did take some money out of that fund at the end of 2013 and put it into this Mayo Civic Center fund because it was the first year of operating financially on its own. I realize they had a commission before that, but it was the first year, January 1 of 14, that the Mayo Civic Center operated as its own separate entity and its own separate fund. We actually probably need, you see that negative fund balance there. We actually made them net fund whole, but we actually were cash short because of some commitments out there with compensated absences. So we probably need to add another couple $100,000 to that fund just to get that at a ground zero spot. And that probably, again, the feasible place to bring that from would be the park reserves, but we haven't quite worked that through yet, and we'll probably be coming forward with a resolution trying to resolve that soon. The airport fund actually had a $438,000 gain this year, which interestingly was about the same amount that we levied for them. But again, we had about a five-year trend on that fund where it was using up fund balance, and this was trying to levy again, was trying to sort of solidify their fund and trying to bring it back up again. They'd spent a fair amount on capital improvements over the years and drawn that down. The transit fund, $70,000 shortfall after the state funding. Again, that's heavily state subsidized, and the Mayo ridership that we get from them, but that did end up $70,000 short for the year. The bioscience building, that's actually operating pretty well. There are some other funds I'm not showing here, the debt service fund and whatnot, but again, that building is like 93% leased up now, and recall we just did some changes on the fifth floor to accommodate the Cardio 3 group, so the leases are doing well in that, and that's cash flowing well. The parking fund ended up $1,270,000 to the good, and again, we're trying to build reserves in that fund for one thing, we're going to take $3 million out of there as part of this switch around with Cardio and pay down some debt early on the bioscience piece of that. But also we've got some development projects, and just the whole DMC plan has a lot of parking facility issues going on that will need some funding in years to come. The sewer fund, showing a negative $677,000. I'm actually thrilled by that. I know that sounds terrible, but again, first of all, that is that's after $8.9 million of non-cash depreciation. So from a cash basis, it's putting away cash at the end of the year, right? But ever since we built that big expansion of the facility, we were operating at a negative year-end operations because of such a large depreciation amount. So we went through a series of rate increases. We knew this when we did the building in the construction in the first place, but we've slowly been decreasing that negative amount every year. So it was about $2.5 million negative last year. So we've been slowly building this up to where we're going to reach a break even pretty soon. But we do have a negative total fund balance because we still have about $172 million in debt outstanding on the sewer fund. So stormwater fund actually this year shows a almost $1 million gain, but that's largely because the number of projects really didn't get off the ground this year. It's about half of this fund that's just operation and maintenance activities, but then the rest of it is all these different projects that they want to get going and they're trying to get going, but by the time they do studies and by the time they do engineering, and some of the projects falter a little bit, so they just haven't got off the ground. But I think Richard will be coming in talking about how they just have quite a backlog of projects they need to be getting done there. So equipment revolving fund, you recall, that's just our that actually owns all of our equipment, and then the departments pay lease payments or rent payments to the to this fund, and this basically just means that we didn't draw down as much as we took in at lease payments this year, but in the coming near future, they'll be talking, I assume fire will be talking about needs to make some significant fire truck replacements, and those eat up this fund balance in a real hurry.
And you killed me already.
I keep saying I'm not going to take away other
department's
presentations, but I'm not going to do
it. Sorry.
And then ITRF, again, that's a similar concept to the equipment revolving, but it's all with our computer systems, and we just, different projects that we had going, and I think this year was primarily virtualization servers that we've been planning for a couple of years and building up money for it, and we spent a lot on that this past year. The health and dental life insurance, we had a $1.6 million gain so far. We haven't finalized that yet because we don't have our final incurred but not reported numbers in. Again, a good year for us. We've had actually a number of the last few years have been good in terms of we're self-insured on this health care. But that's an $11 million a year expenditures kind of thing, which can quickly go the other way on us. And you may recall, some of you have been here a while, that when you live through some years where we were really trying to get up to the point where we could cover our expenses this year because we had some high claims that were just really hanging on for a long time. So. And the property liability insurance and the workers' comp funds, those are the ones that are property liability this year for the first time in a while actually had a positive balance, or positive year-end results. And the work comp actually was $85,000 negative. But a couple years ago, we added $500,000 each into these funds because they've been really kind of suffering over the years, not being able to keep up with the claims experience that we've been having in those. And there are still a number of pending claims that we have no idea where those numbers are coming in. So that's just kind of a quick picture of as you guys ask sometimes, what are the buckets of cash? The one that I have left off of here is the construction account stuff. That's non-operating stuff, and those budgets carry multiple years, and so it's kind of hard to look at that from a year-to-year trend kind of thing because there's projects like we're about to do where we're going to issue $46 million in debt, and it'll take 3 years to spend that out. So that's a quick overview, and I'm open to where you would like to go with this, whether there were questions off the details you had, or I'll start writing it down, whatever I can answer.
So. I'll start off, and Dale, this is great. This is what I was looking for. You touched on it. Oftentimes we wonder what are the fund balances. It's difficult for us to know that. And then also seeing the impact from the prior year is good to know. You know, when I look at things like the airport fund and so forth, because we knew that was a challenge. So those are a couple of the quick takeaways that I had. Mr. Ruskin.
Two things. One, I see Paul's here. So Paul, can you touch base on golf? I mean, we continue to see that pot get deeper. Has there been some type of plan on what you might do to get that turned around?
Yeah, it's easy to blame it on the weather. I'm not going to put it all on that. We've had quite a few things. One of the issues we've had is we've seen a drop off of golf overall, and yet those that do come to our courses have a pretty high expectation. We've done some marketing efforts this year to get more people out. We've gone after fundraising tournaments and other activities, so we're hoping to turn that around. Also going through a staff transition in leadership in golf. Buck stops here this year because I'm directing golf in the interim until we make that change permanently for next year.
Can you give me a tea time tomorrow about 4?
The
other question I had,
I thought he was going to volunteer to run a charity event.
The other question I had was, in under the general, we have, under other finance prior year, we have that $1.4 million. This is I got the breakdown sheet that you provided us, and it looks like that basically comes out of two departments. One of them would be contingency, and I think the other one is the library. Does that sound right? It's on the first page. It's at $1.382 million that it was actuals and budgeted.
Oh, you're talking about the revenues in the general fund up there at the top? I don't have that sheet. Well, I do too have it.
What special sheet did you get?
You're looking at the revenues, overall revenues.
Yeah, and I see there's two, looks like two departments where that looks like the majority of those dollars came from it. It looks like $760,000 was from contingency and then $578,000 from library.
That's actually not. So the revenue side of it, I should have... If you really look at the $2.8 million and you want to know where most of that came from, I mean, there's pluses and minuses of small amounts, but that $2.4 million largely came from the police department, $350,000, largely salary and savings because they were taking a while to get rehired in positions that they had authorized. Chief mentioned that last week. Fire has $367,000, which again I'll let them talk about in a second, to the good. But that was kind of split over a number of different areas, revenues and expenditures that they had savings on. And then a large part of the revenue side that you're looking at, Ed, at the top section there, is actually $975,000 is from building and safety, with about $800,000 of that alone just in the building permit revenue side, which usually means, okay, development's taken off in Rochester, they're buried with more plans than they can possibly get to, but it always looks good for our bottom line because we end up adding money to the bottom for that. And in those slow years, that's when our budget, we didn't have enough to carry over hardly by the end of the year because we weren't getting in enough permit revenue. So that first section that you're looking at is only the general fund revenues. Library sits in its own fund, so it has a whole separate set of revenues on its own.
Right, well, I have that page, and it shows other financing prior year, other financing, and it has a budget of $578,000 deficit, and it has a zero actual.
Okay, I need to get on the same page.
Sorry, I guess this is...
What's the heading?
It's City Department Revenue Expenses Summary, 12/31/14.
Okay, got it.
It's the one you sent out a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and you're in the contingency area? Or
well, this is library fund. The contingency...
Oh, library fund, okay.
Yeah. See how there's a zero balance for actuals and then 578 negatives for budgeted?
That's the encumbrances from the year before and... bulk of that for the library's gift fund.
I got you.
They have a gift fund that they roll over from year to year.
I see what you're talking. You're talking about the prior year, other financing prior year numbers is what you're talking about.
Yeah, it has budget and then actual and there's zero. I mean, it seems like it's a big differentiation. And then also in the contingency, there's that actuals of zero and then 760,000 budgeted. So I see, you know, they're just two numbers.
That was the last part of the $2.4 million. We spent $780,000 roughly of $100 million start on the
So that's part of that then.
Right. So between police, building safety, and contingency, and fire, we pretty much made up that full $2.4 million.
Okay. Yeah, it looks like the rest of the budgets are pretty close.
But that prior year financing thing is, it's encumbrances for contracts that we already have in place at the end of the year, or like Carrie said, the library has this gift fund that they, every time they get money donated to it, they carry the balance of that over to the next year because they really could spend all of it in 1 year if they wanted, but they don't, and again, I'll let Audrey talk to that when she gets to her section.
Usually it seems like when they have budget, the actuals are pretty close to the budget, so that's where it's based on my eyes.
I see.
Okay. Other questions? And otherwise, I'd really like to move on to Dale being able to give his department overview.
So I will...
Do you want to talk about electronic forms of some of this? Because a number of times I've been interested in the city budget electronically. Is that something we're still looking at, probably producing?
It might be out there right now. I don't know. I know they're working on it, but we asked for that.
Okay, I just want to keep prodding because that's something that I think a lot of people would use.
I know they took the entire budget and split it into the section. I don't know if they have it out on the live website.
Well, thanks for pulling up.
So briefly, finance department, we ended up $24,000 to good in the finance area, primarily due to salaries, $178,000 positive in the information system. Again, we had salaries where we had positions that turned over. It took us a while to get those positions found and hired and installed again. And we had, you authorized a new position, and that took us a while to get hired again. City hall maintenance is actually due to some energy savings. You know, we actually had a cool June, and basically it takes a lot more to cool this building than it does to heat it with the steam situation. So we had about $20,000 or so in energy savings, and the rest of it was The roof, the city hall, we had some money in there to repair the city hall roof, but we ended up turning that into a capital project because we're going to try and figure out just exactly what to do there, because it turned out that we found some more things than we thought in that process. It's the second page after the first one, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
He's there.
All right.
It happened to neighbor.
So this is after the summary. Now moving on just to challenges. It's just this ever-increasing activities with our level staffing. We have 10 employees in just the finance area that goes back a long, long time. We increased it to 11. I think we're finally up to 12. Like with it. Since 2004, we added one person, and that's a 9% increase, but we've had increases in expenditures of 32%. I realize it's hard to compare that because it depends on what kind of transactions and all that, but we just continually have more and more activities going on, and we have essentially the same people trying to do this. And then one of the other things that we're facing is just this turnover of staffing. It's not just our finance department of 12 people that we call on to make all this stuff get recorded. There's somebody, in at least one person in every single department, maybe two or three depending on how big the department is, that's what we call our accounting liaison, and they do the payroll input stuff, or they make sure that it gets there. They get all these accounts payable transactions entered onto our enterprise system. So those people are all helping this happen, and we come in more of a review and audit process and processing process. But some of those positions, you know, there's a lot of retirements that are starting to happen, and all the way from the approval people to the people that are inputting are turning over, and we're just having to spend more time trying to make sure things get done properly because people haven't been there for a long time and maybe don't even know how to train someone new, because by the time we get somebody hired, oftentimes the person that was there is long gone. So that's one of the challenges. So one of, and Carrie can speak to this more, but one of the positions requests that we have, again, this is from last year also, is to add a new employee at, we call the RPEA, as a professional association level, a senior accounting tech / internal auditor. And we just are not getting out into the departments nearly as much as we need to, should, or want to. Actually, Carrie, years ago when I came here, 20-some years ago, Carrie was our internal auditor, and we basically kind of gave that position up as we had no ability to add people, but a whole lot more activity going on. We just had to take the position that used to do that kind of thing and put him into more of an operations position. So, again, this would be a position that would report to Carrie, the assistant finance director, and do more in-depth audits and out into the departments and helping them go through the process of making sure they're following all our controls, features and everything, so we don't find anything by the auditors. This is very difficult to do, I realize, when you're comparing it to 35 police officers that you're asking for, because I don't have response time issues, and the only time everybody cares about whether we're here or not is if we...
The fire department wants 35. 13.
But the only time everybody cares or realizes we're having trouble is if we don't make payroll, and everybody knows we're having trouble, right? Or if we have some major audit finding that somebody comes up, and by then it's way too late, right? So what we're trying to do is try and stay on top of those things before it ever gets to that level. And then the second one, and we're not really asking for this right now, but we're just, you know, again, putting you on notice, this DMCC thing, we just don't know exactly what kind of activity this is going to generate, but just given the plans that are out there, it's not small. I mean, to date, it's been largely Gary and I and Carrie that are trying to figure out the accounting sides of this whole world. And what this really means. And the transactions that we've done to date have not been a large number. They've been significant dollar amounts, but not a large number of transactions. But if we start getting into doing a whole lot of projects, and we have to do project accounting for all these different things, which I'm assuming we will, then it definitely creates more staff workload for us. So we're just letting you know that that would probably require a senior accounting technician or something like that to help handle that activity. But again, partially funded, we hope, we think, at least 50% through the DMCC funds. Now, information systems, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, not because fire is staring at me like that, but because we have...
Wait, that's all it takes?
But because we do have this whole integration, whatever it's called, integration committee group or whatever that Aaron's chairing, and we have a report coming to you in about another, I don't know, month or less.
It was IT integration, right?
Yeah, so that's the RPU library and city.roch group trying to figure out ways to make this work there. And Carol Apel has declined to request any positions for this coming year, both because, A, we've gotten a number from the council in the past, and we sincerely appreciate that, and support of the other departments as well. And B, we kind of want to see how this all shakes out before we decide what we really need from this point going forward, assuming this integration part is successful. So I will just leave it at, we just have a lot of projects going on all at the same time and involve a lot of different people and departments. Just a few examples I listed below, and I'll just skip over those because I'll just keep moving along. But you're aware of most of them, I think. It's just a significant impact. One thing I did want to point out that was brought up at the last council meeting, this idea of a mobile notification app or whatever it might be, so that I think some are using Click Fix. We thought it was going to be answered by the Public Works asset management software. As we get further into it, we realize this isn't really quite ready for prime time, and we actually have something within our website system that actually we're pretty impressed with. And again, our concern was to try and get something that would hit all of the departments. We didn't really want to have it be just the Public Works notification. Acela has something that it can do, so our hope is that this website version will actually interface with Acela and Public Works' system and the other, anything else, so that it isn't just related to manhole covers and street problems, you know. So that should be coming out soon. They're going to be previewing that with the department heads or departments pretty soon. And then City Hall maintenance, again, just the struggle there is just mainly just keeping up with part-time staff and just trying to find people who will do the off-hours cleaning and that kind of thing, just a constant battle. But the City Hall roof is probably the big one, and Steve and I have been meeting with architects and roofing people, trying to figure out the solutions. You may have noticed we've been done some test work. You approved the amounts to at least put some perimeter drip caps, I guess I'll call it, and a few other things on these walls that stick up above the City Hall roof and try and stop the leaking issues that we've had that are going on there. But we know we need to replace a roof, but we want to make sure we fix these other infiltration areas first and make sure that we've gotten on top of that. But that will likely be coming, what we did in the CIP process, but it'll probably take a couple of years of CIP requests to get that fully addressed. It's a 20-year-old building, and there's definitely things we need to do to get on top of that. And then in terms of the position, I don't really know if it belongs here, if it belongs in IT or where it is, but it's a similar concept with the IT integration. Is there's just a number of departments with significant facilities that are doing their own thing, and I would just like some way. I don't know that it's a new person, but at least a position of maybe one of our larger facilities that is elevated at some level. And sometimes it's not just a coordinating issue. Sometimes it actually becomes a control issue too, to be honest with you, because people like to head off in their own directions a lot of times, and you could really probably save a lot more money if you could just get on the same page on some of these things. So it's in the areas of the HVAC system controls, the access controls, the security camera issues that we see it on the IT side of the world, but then there's a whole lot of other energy use, purchasing coordination of supplies and maintenance items and that kind of thing that I really think somehow if we didn't have to go to a full department of facilities, but at least at some level coordinate that a lot better than we are, we'd save a whole lot of money and pay for that position in the long run. I'm done.
And that position's been also indicated by some other departments, and it's part of the, so far, it's 52 positions being requested for 2016.
Starting to gain up.
All right, questions for Dale.
Thank you, Dave. Because it's
first department not requesting a position.
Well, they are.
Yeah. Well, IT, I guess. Excuse me.
If this is centralized control, how is that going to impact your department? Will one person be enough for?
Well, we just help our computer department know what way to go because they're getting requests from multiple divisions, departments, saying, we want to put this security camera system in and we want to be able to get to it from home, from wherever, whatever. And another one said, well, we've already got one. We've had it in place for a long time. Why can't you use that one? Well, we already went out and did bids on this and we've got this is what we like best. And it's the same thing on HVAC systems. We're supporting five different building HVAC systems with remote access to all five of them so that something happens in the weekend or alerts go off, people think. But that's just a lot for our IT department to constantly be on top of all these different systems that really are doing the same thing.
All right, David.
Are you worn out by now? We're never worn out.
There you go.
It's not midnight yet.
How do you think they keep their budgets under control?
Hey, are these guys all
early,
or what, what's going on? They're all bailing.
Fairly
obscure. We are.
Do you get that much?
Wait, you get two.
Boy, you must really have seniority. You're new. You're still on probation. That looks really well.
All right, Chief.
Well, a lot of respects, we're like finance. We're doing more and more with the same amount of people or less. I thought I'd start off just talking about last year's from a response perspective. Our trend, statistical trend, was proven accurate again for another year. Call volume was up, I think last year was 3.5%, but we've been averaging about 4% for a number of years now. So what that means at the street level, it becomes fairly common for us to have very few units available at a given time, sometimes for brief periods nobody's available. Last Friday, sitting in a meeting, we were out running around on a bunch of different calls. Pretty soon we had one fire engine left for the whole city, and that's not uncommon. Reflection of just our increased call volume and demand for service. Well, you know, what have we done about that? I mean, historically, we put another fire engine together, another crew, if you will, here a few years back by reducing staffing on a couple of ladder trucks and taking the driver away from the battalion chief. That gave us another fire engine, because we already had the fire engine, another crew for a nominal amount of money, just the promotional cost for those people. We've reduced responses to certain types of alarms that statistically are not typically not fires. We used to send an additional unit to a reported fire alarm, say in a commercial building, but typically, especially in many of the commercial buildings, they have an alarm system. There's someone on site, so if it were an actual fire, you get multiple follow-up phone calls beside the alarm. So what I was trying to do with some of those moves is create some capacity, if you will, in the system without having to hire people. And so we've done things like that. We've cut back calls here and there, added some on ones that when we get a call, we know it's most likely going to be something significant. So we expect that trend to continue. Our goal, we always say, is 90% of the time, 4 minutes or less. We're slipping. We're going to have to, like, I don't have good stats for you today, but I can scrub those and probably get you some. But we're down into the overall, probably in the around 80%. And I expect that trend to continue just because of volume. On the budget side, I was sitting here chatting with Vance while Dale was talking, and I was shocked and pleased that we made a budget last year, because we had a number of challenges. We had a number of retirements and some injuries, and so what that means then, since we have to staff our eight units, that we spend overtime to keep bodies on there to protect the citizens. And at the same time, we had a number of unexpected expenditures, particularly revolving around the stations, probably in the neighborhood around $50,000 between the stations, HVAC problems, roof and gutter repairs. We had to replace a compressor, a backup generator, computer at one of the stations got fried in a lightning strike, just on and on and on. Pretty soon we spent $50,000. So thank you, Council, for the CIP for the current year, because a lot of that money last year we were intending to make updates. We're talking about a 20-year-old building here. Well, our other stations are that 15 to 20-year-old, that they're at that point where they need tile and carpet and kitchen cabinets and energy upgrades. And so that's what we're endeavoring to do this year. So we did make budget. Part of the reason we made budget, though, is because of extra revenue from the state, because of First Class City and our insurance fund. So we were tight. And we didn't have quite as many retirements as we thought we might have had, so that helped, too, on those packages. In terms of future, as you can guess, I'm here kind of outlining our case for staffing. If you look at us from a comparison, and you have to be careful, I don't want to come here and wave national averages that there's so many firefighters per thousand in this community or that community, because that's not the entire story, obviously. But it is somewhat of an indicator and something to kind of just give you a sense. We're around 0.85 firefighters per thousand of the population, and that's about half of the national average, somewhere in that range. And before I say, well, the sky is falling, it's not. There's a bit of a reason for that. Rochester has a long history of aggressive code enhancements, dating back to a couple chiefs ago, Chief Ollie Mertz, very, before they were required on a state and national basis, very aggressive with requiring sprinkler systems in buildings. And so a lot of our major commercial buildings have pretty good protection. Statistically, our numbers of structure fires has remained about constant over the years. Our medical calls obviously have gone up. And but again, it is an indicator that our bottom line is our current demand for service is we're on that trajectory now where it's going to outpace our ability to deliver it. And, you know, on any given day, we're there. Out into the, most of the time, we're fine, but, you know, we're right on that edge for a couple more bad things happening, and we may not have anyone to respond, at least not quickly. We can call Stewartville Fire or Byron Fire, but you can... You don't need a stopwatch to know that 4 minutes isn't going to even come close to them getting into town to help us. So, and if you start looking in terms of DMC and the comprehensive plan, and you start projecting some of these statistics out to 2040, you know, we're going to be on a pace of probably doubling, or not quite doubling, but you would need to add 3 or 4 more crews. And in rough fire chief math, a crew is about 12 bodies, 9 to 12 bodies, depending on what portion you want to fund with overtime, what portion you want to fund completely with the person, the salaried person. The other thing that's happening that's related to growth and related to DMC is, and again, in another efficiency move a few years back, Deputy Chief Swisher was our fire marshal, and he was promoted to deputy chief. And the math worked out, if I could keep him a portion of the time as the fire marshal, I would have enough savings to pay for another inspector, another set of boots on the ground, if you will, to do investigations, to do inspections, to do plan reviews, which all is related to development in the city. So between the slight savings there, I was able to add an inspector and put another engine company for a personnel cost that was about even, about flat. So I'm at this point, I'm out of administrative solutions for this type of thing. We're at some point very, very soon, we're going to need another crew. Now, there's a couple of approaches. One is you incrementalize it. Okay, if you look at our statistical thing, we're going to need about 1.65 firefighters a year to keep going to catch up. But that doesn't help you for a number of years from an actual response perspective. The other approach is, well, hire me an engine company, $1 million plus. And that's a big bill for the city and the taxpayers to swallow all at once. So what we're looking at for next year is half of that, and I think there's some enough savings and some revenue. We'd have to do a little more legwork on it to take some of the bites, some of the costs out of that approach. I'm suggesting we hire six bodies but keep our staffing level at the same. We generate some savings to reduce overtime costs. We would also, so we'd have a little bit of built-in buffer, so on certain days in the interim, you'd have an additional unit on the street potentially. On certain days when you're at the minimums, you would be status quo as we are today. And that would help push us forward, help give us some additional response capacity. The other thing out into the future, and I'm just talking on staffing needs, I'm talking about in the coming year, without that full-time fire marshal too, you need somebody to really pay 100% of their time attention to plan review and development and code issues and on and on and on. We have already sporadically get complaints from developers and builders that, you know, we're not getting the plan review done quick enough. And, you know, so we've been chasing it, you know, but it's just it's simply a staffing issue, and it's just all related to volume. That's the people side. Now, if you further on in my talking points here, you'll note that in the future, at some point, we're going to need somebody else in emergency management. Again, if you look at comparisons, McCounty's got three people. There's quite a population disparity. You look at St. Paul, they've got six people, I think, or Hennepin has four, and St. Paul has six.
No, they're both like six and six.
Okay. So and that's going to become a future need. And on the non-people side of things, apparatus, we bought three fire engines in 2009 and 2010 at very, very good price. We went through a purchasing consortium, but a very, very good price, I should say, for Dale's sake, by fire engine prices. They're still very, very expensive, but we did that, and the shelf life on those is probably a max of about 15 years. We try to, in theory, run them first out the door for about 10 or 11 years, and then put them into reserve status. Well, we need reserve status because stuff breaks or just needs an oil change, or since we don't have mutual aid or help from our neighbors that I can get quickly, those extra fire engines are the ones we use when we call people in at 3 o'clock in the morning at time and a half rates to help us on whatever call volume or significant fire. So that's going to be a financial challenge too. We have had some discussions at the administrative level about alternatives in terms of, can we, as we get bigger, can we have more of a mixed fleet, maybe some smaller vehicles and kind of a mix of things. Now we're at the point where that's a bit problematic because with our call volume and overlapping calls, which vehicle do you take to which call, and then you get caught sometimes with having the wrong vehicle with you. So our basic unit of service delivery is basically a fire engine. It's got, you know, 99% of what we need to do our jobs in that vehicle. So, but at some point, as we were to get bigger, there might be some alternatives. Some were in a mixed fleet to have some smaller, some larger. And on fleet, we saved quite a bit of money here a couple of years, was it 2 years ago on the rescues? Mm-hmm. We were looking at going to a large single rescue unit, the vehicle that would cut cars apart and those heavy-duty types of things. But the more we looked at it, the cost seemed to be too high for the service life of that vehicle. So we went back to the two rescue concept and took the existing box off the back of basically a heavy-duty four-wheel drive pickup and put them on new chassis. Result, you know, $400,000 versus I think we spent about $110,000. So, you know, we are looking for efficiency in some of these things, but at a certain point, you know, you're going to have to replace these vehicles. I think we've got three engines coming up, four engines five. Coming up, five engines.
Five engines, two ladder,
two ladder trucks. Easy, huh? Basically, the fleet. The fleet's got to roll over.
Total of seven engines and two ladder trucks are due, yep. 17, 18, 19.
Yeah. And that's, you know... and in terms of, you know, DMC and comprehensive plan projections, it's you know, it's all the same to us in many respects. If if we get more infill development, that means more volume closer in. You might degrade response times because of density, so we're probably going to need another crew. If it spreads out, need another station eventually. Typically, I wouldn't think development would follow one pattern or the other. It's probably a mix of both, so we're going to be in the position of having to add units to an existing station, which is efficient in that you don't have to add a building. If that station is located in a profile that fits where they're gone too much on a call and you need to add a second unit, Station 4 is starting to get to that point right now, up northwest. So we have a number of challenges, and I'll let you read through some of the recommendations there. But basically what we're looking for next year, or long term, I guess, in the short term of 16 and 17, is put another full crew on the road. Get me halfway there next year is what we're looking at. And I think it's critical that if we're going to sustain and help and assist development, since we are a fire department, not only is the plan review important, but the code enforcement is important. So a fire marshal would be critical. And then also look at some land for an additional station or stations. I have the advantage or disadvantage of having a wife in real estate, and there's lots of property being scooped up there, and I would not like to see the city have to pay too much of a premium out into the future. I could talk for another 3 hours, but I guess probably questions would be more appropriate.
You know, Chief, as you've been talking, I think you've been kind of poking at one of the issues that has been ongoing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was looking at our calendar. I see one of the line items we have, hopefully for later on, a discussion, is a police and fire staffing model.
Sure.
Because I think we're seeing this pattern where we want to fully support public safety.
Sure.
That's fundamental of what we want to do. But, you know, we're hearing that next year fire department might need a request of 7. Police department, they said 13. You know, so we're up to around 20.
Yeah.
And it just, the needs continue to outstrip our capacity.
Yes.
And I don't know what the answer is. Because then, and that's before we start talking about roads and police treatment and some of the other things that need our attention as well. So I really don't have a question there other than just a comment. I don't know how we ever get ahead of that.
Well, I got one comment again, but it's just probably a short-term help, and we'd have to sit down with Dale and really do some data analysis, and at least in the short term, might be able to generate some overtime savings and some savings on the and revenue on the fire marshal side to offset the cost of those positions. But I didn't want to get too much in the weeds in this presentation because my understanding was more about
comment.
Yeah.
Mr. Belgrack, Chief, do you keep track of how much time they're at scenes of fires versus assists?
Well, we could run a report.
Just curious because I know you're getting a lot more calls now. I mean, this is where we're talking to those who have mobility issues are calling if they're going to have problems, and how do we help them get them around? Because you can't just throw some of these motorized chairs in the truck and go. I mean,
I guess a couple of thoughts. We don't, the citizen assist type of call is not a huge number of calls for us. Secondly, I know I've had a couple conversations with a citizen that's concerned if something were to happen to them and their battery died and whatnot, I've just told her to call 911 and you know, we're not going to leave you on a street corner. We'll figure something out. And our captains are bright, enterprising, solution-oriented folks, and we have pickups with lift gates or whatever we need to do. We're not going to leave you on the street corner. We're going to take care of you. But yes, we do track times through our when they're on scene and when they leave.
The reason I bring that up is that a lot of people say, "Well, the fire department doesn't do anything but sit around." The fact is, they do a lot of training and these types of calls. I mean, they're out constantly. So I think it would be kind of an important thing to show us. I think it would be helpful to also looking at kind of how we figure out
yeah, well, there's
what more people want.
You know, the challenge, I think, touched on a couple of things. Our call volume, in the past when the fire department didn't go to medical calls, there was more capacity, more downtime. And over the years, because of going to medicals, which is a fundamental value for the citizens, which is one of the reasons Rochester has one of the highest survival rates for cardiac arrest. You know, over the years, we've eaten up that capacity. And then on top of that, you have the training requirements. There's a licensing requirement now in the state of Minnesota. And our medical skills are expanding. So there's a heavy emphasis on training because the consequences of doing something wrong are high.
Question about response and the way our roads are. Mm-hmm. We're doing some road dieting. Is that, and I know that's up by one of the stations, I'm just curious, has that had an impact on your response time?
The roads?
Yes.
You talk about the condition of the roads? Or
I'm talking about the shrinking of the widths of the lanes.
Oh, light chance. Bike lanes.
Sure. Sure. I mean, it's always a concern if you put more people in a congested corridor with bike lanes. There's always some more risk. The thing that really slows any sort of emergency vehicle down, of course, is any of those speed humps, those types of things. Terrible in a fire engine.
Yeah. Well, like again, you know, we're looking at how even congested Broadway is between 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock, and I've watched fire trucks try to get through there. And it's amazing they don't hit every car, but they come.
Yeah, well, we do have the traffic preemption system, and that's something I didn't even put on here. But our preemption system is going to need to be updated or replaced in the next so many years, and that's not inexpensive.
Right. How many inspectors do we have currently?
Well, we have three.
Three, and we're losing one, or we've lost one?
No, he will be going back to shift. We will replace him when he comes back. But once again, for a fire marshal or assistant fire marshal, it's about a 3-year school of time. Right. So from the time you take him in, get him competent in the three areas of functional responsibility, arson investigation, code enforcement, and public education, it's about a 3-year school of time.
So how far behind are we on our code enforcement?
Probably three fire marshals. Right now we have the capacity to address all the new construction. Our arson load and some of the required inspections that we do, which is basically the beer liquors. Any other building in town, we do not conduct any type of ongoing maintenance inspections. If we do get a complaint for the inspection, or a complaint on the facility, we'll go follow up with it. And generally we do a follow up, we find substantial issues with the building that take a number of months to get corrected, if not years.
In the past, we had fire crews do inspections. They had an inspection district, but there just isn't the capacity to do that. So we've discussed some other approaches that would help in some respects. There's a couple of models around the country where they have a business does a low-risk business, low-risk as in terms of a significant fire, would do a self-inspection based on a format and submit that. That's one approach that might have some value. And then if you get a fire crew, it's difficult if you're going to get into any in-depth inspections to get the proper training for them. So there's a number of challenges there, too. So
yeah. Right now, we're running into capacity issues. You know, the example I'll use is Mr. Hickey. Councilman Hickey had an issue that was brought up to him that sat on my desk for 6 months, and it wasn't that it was not an important issue. It was just a lower priority than the other issues that were coming on. And we're finding that to be the norm more than what happens normally. So, you know, we have citizens out there that have an issue, they have a valid issue they're concerned about, but it ends up being a lower risk threat for us, so we end up prioritizing it. And then it sits there for an unrealistic amount of time.
When Station 2 open?
Well, we're thinking about the middle of May now. We have we're missing one piece for the stations.
It's not the keys, right?
Oh, we got keys.
Okay, good.
There's some other parts to it that are missing. Yeah. They get kind of crucial.
Like beds.
I won't ask any more questions.
The mechanism. But no, it's going pretty well. We're just, you know, still really, really scrutinizing every nickel on that station. because we're very, very tight on that budget, but we're in relatively good shape. We're not going to ask for $1 million, so.
Oh. I probably used up my allotment for the day, so I'll make it pretty short. A few of the things I wrote down, I think, show we're kind of on the same page here, is that diversification of responsibility. What used to be the purview of the fire department is just growing and growing. And one of the ways I see that is the comment about, you know, the Northwest, if we keep growing out Northwest, and we saw the feedback from the comprehensive plan, the only regions that they showed growing in green, well, most of the regions that they showed growing in green were the Northwest. So I just want to make sure you're giving the feedback about cost of continued fire protection for growing Northwest Rochester to the group that's driving the comprehensive plan.
I submitted a number of comments to Mitzi Baker.
Perfect.
For comp plan, but you know, to some ways it's immaterial if they grow Northwest or they, you know, it's all call volume to us. Now the people are the big cost now. If our geographic area spreads, of course, you might need another facility.
Yeah, and so I think that was a really good, you know, I just want to make sure that feedback's happening. Another part that you hit on that I think is important for us is that, you know, we talk about the future value of an investment today. There's those future returns that are hard to realize from code and inspections mm-hmm. that you won't realize until you're 20, 30 years down the road. And we've, you know, we're taking the benefit right now of what was done 20 or 30 years ago, and now we're living off yeah. maybe some of the savings we've accrued by sprinkler systems. What's the next thing in that regard? I mean, if sprinkler systems was the first thing, is there a next thing we can be looking at right now?
Well, there's a residential sprinkler.
No, that's, I know how dangerous that is.
That, no, that's code now.
Yeah,
code right. And so, I mean, long term, that could have some impact because people don't die from a fire in an office; they die from a fire in their home. But you're not going to see the impact of that for years and years and years. You know, there's new suppression technologies, you know, that are out there that we have some and are looking at others, but. I wish I knew what the next big thing is. I think probably the positive on a national level is that the rest of the country has caught up with Rochester now, where with some of the fire code provisions that we have.
So. I guess besides that, I would say this isn't, it's not surprising. I wish it would be, and wish you would come back and say how we're perfectly safe forever with no increase, but I understand that isn't reality, so yeah. I don't think it's...
Well, and you know, the question I get typically, too, is, you know, I call for an ambulance, why did the fire engine show up? I get that periodically, and, you know, my short answer, and I'm not humorous, I always tell people, so you don't die, and because our system is structured and designed after a best practice, and we're there to be the early people to intervene and with a medical emergency, and that's why we have such a good survival rate, along with Seattle, Washington, Lansing, Michigan, places like that. So
back in the 80s, there was no medical calls. It was all fire, and, mm-hmm. you know, there were two ambulances, and there's still two now, right? There are two locations,
well,
and three now.
Gold Cross has a number of ambulances, depending on the time of day. I think as high as 9, down to 7,
I'm talking
down
about
to 5.
Locations, are they spread out?
They don't go by location yeah. anymore. They do what they call system status.
Okay. Yeah.
So they go by geographic.
They rotate a point.
This is by history. Mm-hmm. So that's why you see them parked out at the mall, parked out by
the I know my neighborhood, the fire truck gets there first.
Yeah.
I mean, they are there.
Okay.
That's the biggest
yeah.
volume of
calls. It just depends, yeah. Typically, sometimes we're there first, sometimes there might be a police officer around the corner, or you know, an ambulance might be coming back from another call. It's designed, you know, but that's why our 4 minutes is critical to get us there first and then have paramedics later. Because, you know, you don't die in the first 5 minutes because you need a paramedic.
Mr. Ruska.
I was going to say, for those of us that were around in the late 90s, the fire department morale and functionality and everything can get tipped upside down if it's not has proper leadership. And I haven't seen an issue since you've taken over, you, Vance, all your leadership. You know, I think whenever you get a little skinny with staff and you're trying to cover a lot of bases, it's easy to get people, you know, to start showing frustration and have issues within the department. And we used to have them, and we haven't had them for years, and I want to thank you for that. And not only that, but I think what we hear from the fire department is the performance is top-notch all the way across, and I think that that also says a lot. So I appreciate your leadership and everything you guys do. We'd love to give you another dozen. But just on a side note, the public safety training facility was something that was invested in here a few years ago, mm-hmm. and then it seemed like one of those things that we didn't quite build right. And yet, you know, I'm kind of wondering, we didn't seem to have enough dollars to get everything done right with the, facility. I mean, I've just kind of heard some feedback that it's not used like it maybe was originally planned. Can you give us a feedback on that?
Well, Rochester Fire's been using that extensively.
Okay, good.
Once someone knows how to do a skill, we try to do in-context training. So we have a pile of cars out there that we flipped over and threw down the hill and to make, like, to make it more realistic, we've used the burn towers. We've constructed a class A with wood. The tower itself has natural gas, and so they could their shipping containers that were made into a bit of a T-shaped structure, and we burn in that. Like any good training officer, my battalion chief and training Chris Bailey has another 99 ideas on what to buy next out there, but. It's a very good start.
I guess I always heard there's no like building to go in and train and to talk and to meet and to go over stuff. It's just a miss there where people you got a parking lot, you got a burn tower, you got a gun range.
Well, that would have been ideal, to have that in the beginning. We've talked internally about maybe putting one of our rehab trailers out there for the summer for our folks to we could fire it up and turn on the air conditioning if we're doing a drill out there in the summer, but. Would we have liked to have a classroom? You betcha.
Yeah.
A truck bay? You bet. But I think it's at least a start.
As long as you're finding a lot of uses for it, that's good. I wasn't sure. That's why I was going to ask.
Yeah, and I think the volunteer departments around there have done some training there. We're actually in discussions with them on doing some skills updates with some of the area departments. We've been working closer and closer with them as much as is practical.
Good. Okay, thank you.
And the three of us had a chance to participate in a hands-on drill on Saturday, which was pretty informative, pretty incredible facility. Councilmember Meade, Dickey, and myself. Mr. Mayor.
How are we doing on protected class? What percent do you have in the department, minorities, women?
Terrible. Well, not terrible. We've made progress. I'm happy to report. Is it as much as I would like? No. I mean, we've made good progress. We've probably doubled the amount of females, I want to say, in the last few years. Our issue, though, is we're not attracting protected groups to even apply. I mean, I think our last application, we had a few more, but we've advertised in niches of the fire service, I guess, to try to attract those, and we just haven't.
It's an upper Midwest issue. It's not just Rochester dealing with it. Unless you're in a large urban environment, it seems to be a challenge. We look at Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, us, incomparable cities to us in the upper Midwest. We're just not attracting minorities into the fire service. And we're not sure why. You look in southern states, out east, out west, they've got a little bit more of a diverse employment population, but for some reason, upper Midwest, we just don't have that attraction.
Well, I think, too, just we require certifications coming in the door, which is a time on the candidates, time consuming, and there's an expense to do that. And we're not quite big enough to hire a group and then train them. There are, in Minneapolis, does some of that. The downside is then you have a large overtime expense because instead of 10 weeks, then you're 6 months maybe, where you're paying a salary but you're not getting any frontline firefighter work out of them. And then the other issue you have, because I've done some of those in my past, is you might have a higher washout rate too. So I mean, there's. Could we do that? Sure. I mean, but there's an expense associated with that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
And that's
it. And we're going to quote the
number of the I didn't realize he wasn't here. Everyone's me.
Sorry.
Aw, thank you. Well, she brought mine. I appreciate it.
I couldn't catch Karen. You had a flag on the appointment.
Is it that easy? Right. You owe me a cup of coffee.
Okay.
Yeah. Come on, I don't want you to know. Here.
So you tell me where.
Sorry, I was a little rushed.
No, it was good. Oh, it was fine. It's a high level for little stuff. Exactly. Oh, and then we'll come back in through the budget process. If it works, I'm going to make that a fund mechanism that'll pay for either of your first Yeah. Oh, it's better to see something here. In reality, it's what it does.
I don't know. Where'd it come from?
It was in the middle of the table.
Oh, I don't know.
You got a recorder, I thought, right?
Four cords. Oh, who's... I'll take it upstairs, yeah.
Isn't that a recording?
It could be Aaron's, maybe.
I bet he
left a while ago.
Yeah, but he might have forgotten it, so I'll take it up there.
Okay.
All right. Yep.
See you soon. Oh, well, you know, some days you like it, some days you don't, Barry.
Did you see who put that on the table?
Is this Aaron's?
Well, I wonder if it is. I bet it's one that he had out there recording.